Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
In the Nafahat al-Uns by the famous Sufi writer Abdurrahman Jami, where he recounts the biographies of many famous mystics in history, he describes a particular event that took place in Herat, where a man famed for his spiritual powers was coming to the city. He says, quote, "One of them was hailed by a large crowd when he entered Herat. The crowd tried to accompany the great saint, but on the road, he publicly started urinating in an unlawful way so that all of them left him and no longer believed in his spiritual rank." This could be seen as an example of a Qalandar or of the Qalandariya, a truly fascinating group of mystics, perhaps Sufi mystics, in history that have often been quite controversial for their antinomian behavior, strange practices, and their disavowal of the basics of religious and social law. At the same time, they have often been seen by the wider society as holy men, perhaps fitting under the wider category of holy fools. In fact, the Qalandariya make up a significant part of the history of mysticism, Sufism specifically, and the history of the Islamic world and Islam. It's a topic that might surprise and even shock some of you, but is very significant to understand this wider context. So let's dive into the fascinating world of the holy fools in Islam. Sufism and Islamic mysticism generally has always been concerned with the question of the nafs. This is a term that in philosophical jargon is often translated as soul, but in the more mystical context it is more often rendered as things like self, more particularly the lower self, as well as ego. The classic Sufi path is one of a jihad an-nafs, a jihad or struggle against this ego, against its many desires, wants, and the sense of an individual self at all. It isn't until the nafs is entirely annihilated, what's known as fana, that we can experience or come to know God as the one true reality. So the mystical path in Islam, and indeed in many other traditions too, includes various techniques of subduing and picking apart this self on the path to annihilation. But in different schools and traditions, these techniques and approaches can vary. Different tariqat or Sufi orders will have different particular such techniques, for instance, and as we've explored in earlier episodes, there have been other forms of mysticism in Islam that wasn't necessarily the same as quote-unquote Sufism, and which had different perspectives still, especially in the earliest days. While the group that came to be known as the Sufiya or Tasawwuf was becoming established in Baghdad in the 9th century, other independent forms and approaches to what we could call mysticism, were also developing in other regions. It is only later in the 11th century, with some of the famous Sufi manuals by figures like Sulami, Qushayri, and Hujwari, that many of these different strands of Islamic mysticism, quote-unquote, became incorporated into a wider vision of the category of Sufism. And one of these distinct strands was one that developed in the wider region of Khorasan, and particularly in the city of Nishapur. They became known as the Malamatiya, or the People of Blame. These Malamatis had a quite distinct approach to the mystical path and to the nafs, or ego. While the Sufis in Baghdad and mystics in other places were often characterized by a clear asceticism, zuhd, and rigorous renunciation practices that were very much visible to the public. They could, for example, wear certain kinds of clothing as a sign of asceticism and so on. The Malamatiya seems to have evolved as a kind of response or reaction to this kind of practice. To them, as the name suggests, visible acts of piety or asceticism were actually detrimental to the mystical path. The goal was, after all, to negate the nafs or the self. If one performed all these ascetical practices or was seen by other people as a very pious person, this was actually dangerous because that leads to the mystic himself becoming proud of how ascetic he is, for instance, and the opinions by other people that he or she is pious will feed the ego rather than dampen it. Instead, these mystics took the opposite approach. They chose to hide their ascetical practices and piety so as to not garner the positive opinions of other people. Some of the Malamati masters seem to have eschewed ascetic practice altogether, and they avoided wearing clothes that could indicate that they were renunciant. To the wider public, they were supposed to look like any other person, even though they might have been deeply accomplished mystics on the inside. But at the same time, even that was kind of dangerous, as one wasn't to see oneself as too pious either. One of the early Malamatis, Abu Hafs Haddad, said, quote, "They, the Malamatis, show off what is blameworthy and conceal what is praiseworthy. Thus people blame them for their outward conduct, while they blame themselves for their inward state." As an example, they could go to different mosques every time they went to pray in order to avoid people sort of noticing that they went to the same mosque a lot and therefore conclude that they were, you know, pious and good Muslims. In a rather beautiful way, the Sufi Ali al-Hujwari says that blame, which is what these mystics were so focused on, has, quote, "a great effect in making love sincere." Some Malamatis even took things a step further and did things that broke the norms or expectations of society, so that they would not only avoid being seen as pious, but even invoke the ire of the public. Thus they got their name, the Malamatiya, the People of Blame, whose mystical practice was to fight their ego by invoking the blame of other people rather than their praise. Quote, "The essence of the doctrine of blame is that the mystic should strive to become totally indifferent to the judgment of his behavior by other people, either in a negative or in a positive sense. To reach this mental state of total detachment, it is necessary to hide one's laudable deeds from the eyes of the people so as to avoid the damage their admiration might do to one's sincerity. One may also go further on this road and erect a facade of blameworthy behavior which provokes the criticism of the respectable community." This Malamati movement was essentially born in Nishapur, and there are a few figures that are particularly associated with it. Hamdun al-Qasar is sometimes even considered the quote-unquote founder of the school, but things are likely a bit more complicated than that. Indeed, other masters like Abu Hafs and Abu Uthman also appear to have been formative and could differ from each other pretty drastically in approach. But they all share in the general Malamati characteristic, a rejection of the self through hiding one's spiritual state or piousness, sometimes even acting in ways that would make people think the opposite of you. The Malamati movement eventually became very popular, and as we saw, it was eventually incorporated into the wider category of Sufism. Sometimes the Malamatis would be a bit more organized, almost like a Sufi order in themselves, but usually the Malamati approach functioned as a kind of, well, like a certain approach within the wider category of Sufism, right? So as a certain flavor of Sufism or a certain technique that some Sufis would employ and would be known for across history. Indeed, the famous Andalusian mystic Ibn Arabi often mentions or lists different categories of mystics within Islam, from Sufis to Arifun to Muhaqqiqun, which means verifiers or realizers. But in many places, such as in the Futuhat al-Makkiyah, it seems that he considers the Malamatiya as the highest and the group that he admires the most out of all of them. As we also saw, the Malamatiya often sought the blame of other people, while at the same time usually still being very strict about following Islamic law, if in secret. There was a spectrum of how far these Malamatis went in their quest for blameworthiness. And toward the end of the Middle Ages, in the 12th and particularly the 13th centuries, there seemed to have developed a particularly extreme form of this movement. One that went even further in their quest to gain the dislike of other people by acting in ways that were seen as deeply offensive and went completely against social norms and sometimes even Islamic law. This, what you could call the more extreme outgrowth of the Malamati tendency, eventually became known as the Qalandariya, or as the Qalandars. One of the earliest references to this group, especially as concerns its distinction from the wider Malamati movement, comes from one of the most famous and formative Sufis in history, Shihabuddin Abu Hafs Omar Suhrawardi. This is not the famous mystic philosopher that founded the Illuminationist school, also known as the Sheikh al-Ishraq, even though they annoyingly share basically exactly the same name. But rather, this is the foundational figure, or one of the foundational figures, of the very significant Suhrawardi Sufi order. In a critical section from his Awarif al-Ma'arif, he says, quote, "The difference between the Malamati and the Qalandar is that the former strives to conceal his acts of devotion, while the latter strives to destroy custom." This is, of course, a negative and critical account, but it does point to one of the key features of the Qalandari movement, a form of self-renunciation through uncompromising social deviance and rejection of custom. Now, it should be pointed out that if you want to be extra nuanced, the Qalandariya isn't the only such group, but existed alongside other similar movements, which were known as the Haidaris, as the Abdals of Rum, as the Shams al-Tabrizis. There are many similar such groups, but the Qalandars are the most famous and have also, at least sometimes, come to be used as a kind of wider term for this general wider movement. And we will kind of be using it in this way in the video for the most part. I'm going to try to nuance it and use these different terms because they are different in some ways, but we'll also be sort of considering this wider antinomian movements or movements as Qalandariya, right? But we should keep in mind that the Qalandars were one particular group of such dervishes or mystics alongside other similar groups that were still distinct and were known by other names throughout history. The Qalandars, in particular, are associated with a primary originating figure called Jamal ad-Din Savi, a fascinating mystic who lived in Damascus in Syria, and after being a traditional Sufi for a while, became transformed into a wandering dervish that used peculiar practices to fight his nafs. The example set by Jamal ad-Din Savi, as well as other formative figures, became a source of inspiration for future Qalandars, who often adopted the same techniques, which can perhaps most widely be divided into two categories, at least according to the scholar Kara Mustafa. That is, one, a extreme form of asceticism, and antinomianism. These dervishes were very distinct in wider society, and this was, of course, on purpose. As we saw, their whole identity was based on social non-conformity and a rejection of customs. For example, the Qalandars seem to have often neglected certain aspects of the Sharia, such as the 5 daily prayers or sometimes the avoided fasting during Ramadan. Rather than being a part of society and following the Islamic ideals of starting a family and having a profession, for instance, they eschewed all of these things. The Qalandars lived lives of extreme asceticism, not having a home, but often living a life of wandering, without any possessions, often except for a begging bowl, a dervish club, certain clothing, and often musical instruments. Although some Qalandars could also walk around completely naked, usually except for a sort of loincloth covering their private parts. Asceticism generally, of course, already existed in Sufism and was seen as a pious way to live, but generally Sufis never went this far. They were still expected to have a family, for instance, and not to live lives of celibacy, which the Qalandars usually did. They thus broke these norms by practicing a very extreme and unusual form of asceticism for this culture. But aside from ascetic practices, they also actively acted in shocking ways as part of this social deviance and antinomianism. This was perhaps most clearly visible in their appearance. As we mentioned, the Qalandars would often dress in very unusual ways, some even walking around essentially completely naked. Otherwise, they would often only wear a loincloth or often animal hides of different sorts, so tiger skin and stuff like that. In the case of the Haidaris, which is another similar movement, they became known for wearing metal bracelets and other iron equipment on their body, including rings hanging from their genitals. Even more shockingly to some degree, and following the practice of Jamal ad-Din Sabi, the Qalandars would also shave off all their hair, beard, and eyebrows, what was known as the fourfold shave. This was in clear violation of the social norms and of the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad, which expected adult males to have a beard. This would have made them stand out very clearly in this society. This was a common practice across all of these antinomian dervish groups, although certain details could differ. For example, the Haidaris appear to have shaved their beard but left their large mustache intact. We also mentioned the fact that they would often carry musical instruments with them, and indeed music and dance seems to have been a prominent aspect of their practice. This was of course common across all of Sufism, but the Qalandar seems to have taken it further and been almost constantly playing music and dancing ecstatically. Couple this with the fact that they seem to have used different kinds of intoxicants too, including hashish and probably even alcohol, likely as another feature of their spiritual practices, so to say. So they would use hashish, for instance, as part of this of spiritual practice, essentially, and they would even consume wine, right? And this was in clear violation to Islamic law, which forbids essentially all forms of alcohol, at least at this point, right? In the 13th century, even those groups like the Hanafis that sort of allowed certain forms of alcohol in the early centuries, at this point, this was basically agreed upon by everyone that this was forbidden according to Islamic law. And so they clearly were breaking many of these customs and norms in very shocking ways. And this was, of course, completely on purpose. The main foundation of the Qalandar path was one of dying to both worlds, quote-unquote, both this world and the afterlife. It's a complete detachment from yourself, including its wishes to get to paradise in the afterlife. And the only way to truly neglect your nafs fully is by collapsing all distinctions, all benefits for the ego by not owning anything, not having a home, even actively doing things like self-laceration and other kinds of self-harm. Coupled, of course, with the rejection of common religious practice, which could also become a kind of pride for the ego, and through this rejection of common religious practice, also inspire the blame of other people. God is everywhere. Ideas of pure and impure, sinner versus believer, are all false. And when we let go of all that, and let go of this world and the next world completely, that is a kind of fana, a kind of death of the ego. The Qalandars were inspired in this sense by the famous saying of the Prophet Muhammad that we are to, quote, die before you die. To the Qalandars, by taking on this path, they had, in a sense, already died. This is also the explanation for why they thought themselves exempt from the rules of the Sharia. Those rules were only for living people. In a very pertinent example of this, it seems that the Qalandars sometimes, instead of performing the five daily prayers, had a practice of saying the takbir, Allahu Akbar, four times regularly. This is a clear reference to funerary practices in Islam, and thus, in a way, by doing this, were reminding themselves of their own death, right? Almost like symbolically sort of stating that they are dead, right? And this was a core of their self-image and their whole spiritual outlook. From their inception in the early 13th century, these Qalandars, as well as other similar groups, became widespread across the Islamic world. The Qalandar movement had originated primarily in Damascus, Syria, and in Damietta in Egypt, where their foundational figure, Jamal ad-Din Sabi, had lived. And they continued to be popular in these regions across the Arab-speaking world too. However, while they were centered in places like Syria, the majority of Qalandars were Iranians and often Persian-speaking. It is thus no surprise that the movement eventually became very popular and widespread in the wider Persian-speaking region, including modern Iran and all the way to the Indian subcontinent. Indeed, as we saw, the Qalandars had as one of their key characteristics the principle of wandering around. So they would often go from place to place, seeing various different regions of the Islamic world in their travels. One example of this from history is the famous Persian Sufi poet Fakhruddin Iraqi, who in his teenage years encountered a group of Qalandars in the city of Hamadan and immediately became enamored and decided to join them. He traveled around as a Qalandar for probably many years, and their travels eventually took them to Multan in India. Here, he eventually changed tracks and became initiated into a more traditional Sufism by becoming a disciple of the famous Baha'uddin Zakariya and joining his Suhrawardi order, which we mentioned earlier. But Iraqi always maintained a kind of ecstatic approach to mysticism even after this. He eventually settled in Konya and became an Akbari under the leadership of Sadruddin Qunawi and wrote the Lama'at, the Divine Flashes, which is one of the great masterpieces of Sufi literature that is almost unparalleled in its expression of divine love. But he also wrote independent poems, which often employed themes of the Qalandariya. And this also became a kind of style or genre of poetry, which was called the Qalandariyat. Indeed, there is also a strong connection between the Qalandars and Sufi poetry. While the Qalandars seem to have developed as a clear, like actual movement as such, around the early 13th century, we do find mentions of them and their characteristics in earlier literature too. It's very common to see themes in Sufi poetry that also challenge the norms as a means of literary expression. The poems of the Sufi tradition, both in like Persian and Arabic, will often talk about wine drinking and taverns and people crazed with love. In the literary sense, this was very rarely meant literally. The tavern and wine were often images that represented the Sufi lodge and the divine love or ma'arifa, a kind of Gnostic knowledge which was identical to love. But for the historical Qalandars, as we saw, this could also become practical reality, or rather it did become practical reality. Listen to this poem from the famous Akbari Sufi Mahmud Shabistari in his masterpiece The Gulshan-i-Raz. Quote, "To be a haunter of taverns is to be freed from self. Self-regard is paganism, even if it be righteousness. They have brought you news from the tavern that unification is shaking off relations. The tavern is of the world that has no similitude. It is the place of lovers that reck not. The tavern is the nest of the bird of the soul. The tavern is the sanctuary that has no place." Or in the writings of the Persian poet Sana'i, who expresses himself in similar, sometimes shocking ways by subverting religious themes. Quote, "Why do you read the Quran like a pious Muslim? Go and have a look at the ruins. Sometimes I play backgammon with the tramps. Sometimes I move my castle, sometimes I'm checkmated. Sometimes I moan like the mouthpiece of a flute. Sometimes I raise my cup in the middle of my devotions. Sometimes my cheek lies in the dust on the ground. Sometimes I cry out toward the heavens. Drunkenness has devastated me so much that I cannot discern words from their meanings. The minstrel is to me a muezzin. I cannot tell deceit from a sincere prayer." If you know Sufi poetry, you know that these themes are very common across the board, like wine drinking, taverns, all these kinds of things. Some of the most recurring language in Sufi poetry. And for the most part, it should not be read literally, of course. This is a mistake I think a lot of people make when they read someone like Rumi, for instance, or that they believe that he's actually talking about wine drinking. This is not the case, right? They're using this language, this shocking Qalandari language, right, to talk about themes of the soul, like love for God, ma'arifa, these kinds of things. It's all metaphorical. Whereas for the actual Qalandars that we're talking about today, they often took these themes and they made them a lived, practical reality. Perhaps especially in Persian poetry, the Qalandars are very common and are often mentioned as Qalandars too. If you've ever listened to Qawwali music, for instance, such as the legendary Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, you'll probably recognize this word from some of those famous songs of his. There is, for instance, the very popular Mast Qalandar, or Mast Mast, that mentions the group of antinomian dervishes that we're talking about today. And unsurprisingly, the Qawwali songs of people like Nusrat are often based on the poetry of Persian or Urdu writers like Amir Khusro. The Qalandars, as well as other groups of similar dervishes, such as the Haidaris, the Abd al-Savrum, Jamis, and the Shamsi Tabrizis, also became quite widespread in the Ottoman Empire and in Asia Minor. Major Qalandari centers, zawiyas or tekkes, seems to have existed in major cities in Istanbul and in Konya, for instance, and many sources from that time describe such activities, telling us that it must have been a quite common and widespread movement in like Asia Minor and Anatolia and what is today Turkey, for instance. Eventually, though, the Ottoman rulers appear to become more strict with such antinomian groups, and we do tend to see a decline over time, or in some cases, a kind of transformation of these groups into more formal and traditional Sufi orders. This seems, for example, to have been the case for the fascinating Bektashis. The Bektashi Sufi order is very famous around the world. They trace their lineage to the 13th century mystic Haji Bektash and has been a very prominent, albeit sometimes controversial, Sufi order in places like Turkey and the Balkans. Their main center today is in Albania, for example. But the earliest attestation of the Bektashi movement comes in the 15th century with the Ottoman writer Vahidi, a very important source for many of these movements in the Ottoman Empire. And in his account, the Bektashis are essentially described as similar to the Qalandars, shaving off all facial hair, wearing particular clothing, performing antinomian practices, and also having very clear Shi'i tendencies, for example, by revering the 12 imams of 12er Shi'ism. Eventually, though, the Bektashi seems to have evolved in some way into a more traditional Sufi order, although they have also retained some antinomian features even to this day. It's worth exploring the Bektashis more in a dedicated episode in the future, but they became important for the Ottoman state as being an essential part of the so-called Janissaries, a kind of Ottoman private army or infantry. And even one of the most accepted and popular, quote-unquote, orthodox Sufi orders in the Ottoman Empire, the Mevleviya, which was founded around the authority of the famous Sufi poet Jalal ad-Din Rumi, was also affected by this wider Qalandari movement. According to Ahmed Kara Mustafa, from essentially the beginning, there always existed two tendencies within the Mevlevi order. One that was focused on a more orthodox interpretation in line with the Sharia, the mainstream, in other words, that came to be called the arm of Valad, which was Rumi's son. And on the other hand, there was another tendency that was a lot more Qalandari in nature, sometimes referred to as the arm of Shams, as in Shams Tabrizi, the spiritual mentor of Rumi. Indeed, it seems to be this group within the wider Mevlevi movement that is sometimes called the Shamsi Tabrizis. The majority of the order remained in the more orthodox camp, however, and it has been widely seen as such by the Ottoman state throughout history. So as you can see, far from being just some tiny anomaly in the history of the Islamic world, the tendency represented first by the Malamatiya and later by the more extreme Qalandars, as well as similar groups, has been very prominent and influential in some regards. Such groups do still exist today, perhaps most prominently on the Indian subcontinent, where antinomian Sufis continue to have a relatively strong presence, but they certainly aren't as widespread as they were in the late Middle Ages and the early modern period. But their influence can surely still be felt in poetry, in the songs of the Qawwali singers, and even through direct and indirect influence on some of the more established Sufi orders that have survived today. Above all, they add more color to the rich tapestry that is religious practice and identity in the Islamic world. And I'll see you next time.
Thank you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host
Niñas Bien Podcast. We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish, but you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast, so everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.